Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 9th of June and you're listening to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and with me is Phil Bishop, editor of our daily news service at theconstructionindex.co.uk. Summer seems to have arrived at last, Phil. Everything's soft and balmy down here in Devon.
It's lovely here in Kent. The sun has definitely got his hat on.
Hip, hip, excellent. Hip, hooray. So, have been anywhere on your holidays recently, Phil?
I haven't been anywhere on my holidays. Have you been on your holidays?
I have.
Did you go far?
No, not very far. Just further down the coast into Cornwall. Yeah, first break I've had since the coronavirus hit, really. First holiday, anyway. So it was pleasant, but tiring, because we were away in our camper van and haven't quite got the knack of sleeping all through the night in a camper van. But I'm sure I'll get the hang of it sooner or later.
Were you sharing the space with your dogs?
No. Dogs stayed at home with the kids.
Ah.
just me and Mrs. Taylor. So fighting over the space in the pop top.
That's probably sensible. My wife and I, we once tried, hired a camper van for a week to see if it was something that we might get into. And we did have two Springer Spaniels in the van with us.
Ooh.
So that was, yeah, sleepless nights.
Yes, I can imagine. Yeah. No, it's great. Obviously, I'll do it again. I'm committed now that I've got the bloody thing. But it was fun. And the weather was good and we found a nice spot and everything was great.
Well, I haven't been on my holidays, but I have been somewhere super interesting. Last week, I spent a morning at the HS2 site at the south portal of the Tiltons Tunnel.
Oh, right, yes.
With a Line joint venture. And it was a beautiful day. I got a pink nose, the gap between my face mask and my safety goggles and hard hat. And it was fascinating to see everything that was going on there.
They've got two big TBMs there, haven't they? Florence and...
Yes.
Celia, is it? Florence and Celia? Just you, Florence and Celia, was it?
There were about half a dozen journalists or so, I'd estimate, on the first press trip since restrictions have lifted to this site. Mm-hmm. And, two tunnel boring machines. I have got a mass of data, which haven't remembered it all, but I'll try and dig some of it out.
Hmm.
But essentially, we reported, as did everyone, it was HS2 announced, that the first TBM to go, Florence Flow, was launched on the, now then, what date was it? 10th of May? 13th of May.
Okay.
She began her drive. And I was visiting on the 1st of June. By the 1st of June, which is a couple of weeks or so later, she'd travelled 106 metres. 53 rings had been lining had been installed, and each ring is 2 metres, 2 metres wide, so that means that she'd done 106 metres.
Uh-huh.
So the whole machine is 170 metres long, so you can still see her back end sticking out very beautifully. But she was more than halfway in, heading towards the beneath the M25. This site in it's basically Maple Cross, Rickmansworth area, right on the edge of the M25, and the first, it's not an obstacle, they go under it, but the first issue milestone to confirm is when Florence passes under the M25, which she should do around the end of this month, with no ill effect to the motorway, no settlement or movement or whatever, then they've got the clearance to set off Celia, the second one, to then start her journey.
How deep is the tunnel? How far underneath the motorway are they going?
It's about the depth of the tunnel itself, and I do have I do have that statistic. 9.5 metres.
Okay. That sounded quite close to the surface, actually.
They've been monitoring and measuring the M25 for about a year now to sort of get to know how it moves naturally, and then they can sort of see how that may or may not change as the TBM goes underneath it. And as one of the, I think it's a chap from a line pointed out, saying, we need to take every precaution, but it's absolutely nothing compared to what they've been doing in London, or did for London for Crossrail, where they're knitting a tube much, much closer than that, above, between, below, all sorts of infrastructure. if you're talking about careful, high-risk tunnelling, that's Crossrail. Need to be careful. The M25 is a very important artery they don't want to disrupt, but it's... I don't want to jinx anything, but it is not expected to be.
No.
And, 9.5 metres is a reasonably long way down. They've done an awful lot of, ground testing and so on before they started tunnelling.
How long is the tunnel? How long will it be?
The Chiltern Tunnel is 15.75 kilometres, 16 kilometres roughly, twin board, two of them. And I mean, there are other tunnels on the phase one of the HS2 between London and Birmingham, but this is the biggie.
Okay.
And there are also five vent shafts, four big ones, and a smaller vent shaft was added at the, not exactly the 11th hour, but while the bill was going through Parliament, MPs changed the legislation to make that tunnel longer. I can't remember how long it was before, but they wanted a bit more tunnel to avoid a few more posh people's houses. And that meant they needed another little vent shaft. It didn't need to be the full-scale ones that they'd already planned, but a fifth vent shaft had to be added.
Is it one of these little jobbies? Because they released some news about a special sort of fake barn-type structure that they would put on top of these things. Is this one of these?
Yes, I don't know if all four are completely different, but they've all been designed to look like barns or sheds in the region. I think we've talked about it before, haven't we? In the region where they're going up.
Yeah.
I think it's Foster Architects have been involved in that.
Yeah.
To provide the little zhuzhuzhu to it all.
Fascinating. So was it, I mean, the big, I can't remember the last time I was actually on a big civil engineering site, but usually quite an impressive site in terms of scale and the sheer amount of activity going on. What was it? What was your impression of it?
Well, it was a huge site, because as well as the tunnel that they're digging, there's also from this site in the other direction towards London, they are building the Cone Valley Viaduct, which will be the longest viaduct in the UK. That is 3.4 kilometres. Right. And they've just started piling work for that. So there's not a huge amount to see there yet, but their site offices are all up at the other end of the area of the site area. I haven't got statistic in front of me for the size of the whole site area, but I have a figure of something like 80 football pitches in my head.
Yes, the universal unit of measurement, isn't it, football pitches?
I don't know what that is in acres or double-decker buses, but, but a lot of football pitches. So there's the tunnel boring at one end and the viaduct to be built at the other end. In the middle, or between the two, are two large factories. One is making the precast concrete segments for the tunnel lining in two production lines, and the other, which is not yet up and running but the building is up, will be making the precast concrete segments for the viaduct.
Oh, right.
So a lot of production going on site. There's also an area where they the spoil from the tunnel excavation comes out in the form of a slurry. They put water liquid to the to the front of the tunnel,
just pump
and all
it
the
out.
Chalk, all the chalk is pumped out as a liquid, and that comes out pumped to a treatment area where it goes through a couple of cyclones, and the sand and soil or whatever is spun out, and they're left with chalk, which is compressed into bricks, and that's set aside to dry for a period of time. And those chalk bricks then go off to a nearby disused quarry to form the basis of landscaping. There's that process as well, and there's a massive great water treatment plant as well to keep all the, you know, and prevent any groundwater contamination and so on. So there are other elements beside the, or in support of the core activities of tunnelling at one end, viaduct at the other. But in spite of this huge great size, or maybe because of this huge great size of the site, my overriding impression was it didn't seem that busy. It just seemed all a bit calm. Now, I know there are COVID protocols and social distancing, and you can't have masses and masses of people working too closely together. And my initial reaction was sort of disappointment, because I was hoping to see something, a really spectacular, something that from an aeroplane would look like millions of ants climbing all over the countryside, building a railway line. And it wasn't that at all. It was all, you know, occasionally see someone wander by. And then I thought about it, and I thought, I shouldn't be disappointed. I should be impressed. And I decided I was impressed because it's basically, it's efficient. I've no idea how many people might have been in all the site hut cabins that were stacked up around the place. But actually, the crew of seven manning the TBM, at the front of the TBM, were obviously out of sight. And relatively automated process. The materials were all being, or key materials of the concrete lining for the tunnel were being produced on site. Wandered around that factory. There were maybe, I'd be hard pushed to say, a dozen. Maybe I saw half a dozen people in the concrete precast plant with the two lines there. But it was it was working, and it was producing concrete segments at the rate that it needed to. And so it all just seemed very calm, very efficient, very matter-of-fact, getting on with the job.
Yeah.
You know, no drama here, no excitement.
But maybe it's like the archetypal swan, all serene and calm on the surface and then paddling away at mad underneath.
There may have been some frantic activity that we weren't aware of. Maybe they'd moved all the madness off-site for our two and a half hour visit, but I don't think so.
No,
it just seems that thoroughly well organised. I mean, obviously this is only one site of the HS2 railway line between London and Birmingham, but it is geographically at least the biggest. It's the largest site for the HS2 project.
I wonder how that would compare to the Euston station site, because of course there's an awful lot of activity going on there. Very, very different environment.
Yes, I haven't seen that. It's a smaller area, therefore more dense, and maybe it does appear more like what I was expecting it to be. You know, a hive of people doing physical work all over the place. But it was all remarkably calm.
I suppose that's one of the advantages of working on a greenfield site, which that effectively is a massive greenfield site. So you know, you're not hemmed in by other buildings and other people and stuff like that.
Well, the other advantage of the physical nature of that site that you just mentioned is because of the COVID protocols have impacted a lot of sites, not just on HS2, around the country. This site had barely been, or certainly its productivity had barely been affected. Mm-hmm. When the contracts were first signed a couple of years ago for the big civil engineering contracts for the HS2 main works, it was considered that the Chilterns Tunnel would be on the critical path. It would be, everything would hang on that coming in on time. That's not the case anymore. They've got underway, got going, and all being well, they don't consider that a particularly time sensitive piece of the project. Now they say they're more, not they're concerned, but the part of the project they're keeping a tighter eye on, which is more time sensitive, is earth moving up at the Birmingham end.
Oh right.
Earth moving is more, I suppose, weather dependent, and you can't control that.
No.
And obviously in tunnelling there are things you can't control, but you can manage to a certain extent. You don't quite know what you're going to hit, but they're feeling pretty good about the tunnelling.
Okay. Fascinating.
Well, that's been my visit to a big construction site. Have you seen any big construction sites lately?
Well, I have, but only virtually via the big screen. Well, the small screen rather, actually. Yes. Well, there's a new documentary on BBC Two, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners will have seen already. But those who haven't, I would urge them to go along and have a look. It's called "Building Britain's Biggest Nuclear Power Station." So no clues. You know, no prizes for guessing what that's about. Let me just make sure that I have got the title right. Yes, it's Building Britain's Biggest Power Station. It's all about Hinkley Point C, and it's on BBC Two. The first episode was last week, and the second is actually tonight at 9 p.m.
Which is Wednesday the 9th of June.
Wednesday the 9th of June, yes, indeed.
but it's on iPlayer as well.
It is. So if you miss it tonight, that's not a problem. Interesting contrast to the site that you've just described, because, of course, anybody who's seen any pictures of Hinkley Point C can see that it's an absolute forest of tower cranes and various other exotic lifting devices. Massive excavations, tangles of rebar, there are, you know, scores of people milling around. I think actually the first episode, I didn't check, but I'm pretty sure that it was actually filmed before the outbreak of COVID-19. Do you think that's probably the case? Because I saw not a single mask, and there wasn't much social distancing going on, so I'm sure that they wouldn't have flouted the COVID regulations. I suspect that it was probably filmed towards the end of 2019, judging by the progress that they depicted. The focus of the first episode was on these two massive concrete pours for the reactor bases. So these are, you know, right at the epicenter of the project. I've written about big concrete pours in the past on civil engineering jobs, but these things were basically concrete discs, heavily reinforced, really heavily reinforced with steel, 50 meters in diameter. And I think, I can't remember how many meters deep.
It's 9,000 cubic meters of concrete. It's the largest ever concrete pour in the UK. That was the first one,
yeah,
in June 2019.
And the second one they did last year?
The second one was just was basically the same, yeah. Just short of 9,000. One is June 2019, the other June 2020.
Yeah.
And they showed it would take about a week to do.
It was 3 days continuously.
3 days.
3 days without stopping. And again, they had an on-site concrete batching plant there. And they show you, they introduce you to all the key personnel, the chap in charge of, you know, the project manager in charge of the pour, and the chap who's in charge of the batching plant. All highly organised. Rather, you said you were impressed by the air of calm efficiency at the HS2 site. It doesn't seem quite as calm on the Hinkley Point job, because it's clearly is a bit nail-biting, because they are trying to do something which is unprecedented, really, in this country at least. But this chap who runs the batting plant is coordinating a continuous relay of truck mixers to and from the site from his batting plant over 3 days, you know, 24 hours a day, this is. And he's got a sort of eye in the sky type visualization of this on screen, so he can see where each truck mixer is at any particular time. One's discharging into the pump, one's actually en route to the site, another one is being filled up at the batching plant. And it's all carefully, meticulously planned and coordinated. And they've got a materials specialist on site who is constantly monitoring the quality and the consistency.
She was very impressive, wasn't she?
Basically, she was in charge of, I mean, I think if she said, you've got to stop now, everything would have ground to a halt. Everything sort of depended upon her say so. She was, you know, they were doing sort of cube tests and stuff like this, and she was checking it, and she was checking the temperature during the cure. So she was, she seemed incredibly relaxed, actually, far more than the other chaps on the site.
And given that so much responsibility rested on her expertise, because they were saying that any excess or any cracking in the base could lead to water ingress,
yeah,
could lead to, you know,
corrosion of the
disaster.
Rebar.
nuclear disaster.
That was one thing which really came across in this episode, was how things had to be right first time. When they were welding up the reactor linings with these big steel things which sit on top of the reactor bases, and they're made out of the liners are made out of steel plate welded together. They do the welds, and then overnight they X-ray every single millimeter of these welds, and then they review them, every single one, and if they find the tiniest detail, they found I think it was an 8 millimeter long void, something like that, a tiny little void in one of the welds. So they said, right, tomorrow we put that one right. You know, we presumably grind it out and do it again. But everything has to be right first time. And again, there's a lot of tunneling going on there as well. They've got three big tunnels going out into the Bristol Channel to collect
cooling water.
Yeah, to collect and discharge the cooling water. And the chap in charge, he was a chap called Rob Birmingham, very impressive bloke, who's totally dedicated to tunnelling. He comes from a long line of tunnellers. We talked about this, didn't we? Do you remember with our folk singing guest a few weeks ago about tunnelling, and how the tunnelling fraternity really is you're sort of born into it. This chap certainly was. And he was saying, you know, that I can't remember how many thousand precast concrete liners there are in these tunnels. But he said the first one has to be as perfect as the last one and all the ones in between. You know, there is no variation. They have to fit perfectly.
As I said, the guy you're talking about, Rob Birmingham, has become a bit of a media star in the making, because he featured in the Crossrail documentary.
Oh, did he?
Back in 2014, BBC Two. Okay. This is when Crossrail was not yet something to
be ashamed of.
We were celebrating the brilliance of the construction.
The civil engineering side of it was brilliant, though. There's no doubt about
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's called £15 billion railway, they call it. They wish. The £15 billion pound railway. The Birmingham family, Rob Birmingham, his brother and his father, are all working on that project.
Oh, together. Right. Okay, there we are then. Yeah. But, he's good value when it comes to telly. He's very good on camera. And his enthusiasm and sheer dedication really came across in this one. Yeah, I found it absolutely fascinating. I'm not a great fan of either HS2 or Hinkley Point C from the political and social point of view, but from civil engineering point of view, you cannot fail but to be impressed. They're huge undertakings. And the other thing about the Hinkley Point documentary was that they didn't just look at the civil engineering technical stuff. They looked at how it would affect the local community. They interviewed a chap who has a furniture business nearby, and he just says, I just wish all these white buses ferrying the I can't wait for these white buses to stop running backwards and forwards in front of my shop, because of course they've got a huge I can't remember how many people are working on the site, but they have to be ferried to and from their accommodation every day. But then there was a butcher's. They interviewed a butcher, family butcher's firm, been there for, I don't know, the last 40-something years. They love it because, of course, they've got to feed all these people. And then, of course, we saw the canteen, and they interviewed the chefs who have to feed these continuous relays of workers, you know, 24 hours. It doesn't really stop. Minute they've stopped doing the dinner shift, they've got to start breakfast again. Was that it? Oh, sorry. Yeah, I just noticed 5,000 people on site at any one time at Hinkley Point C. So I don't know how many football pitches it is, but it's big, but it's all in one place.
Oh, but it's absolutely huge. They did tell us how many football pitches.
I think
I think it's about a quarter of Wales.
No, it's not that big, surely.
No, it's not. It's not even half of Somerset.
But they did say it's the size of a small town, which is easy to believe if you see it from the air. It does cover a large area. I made a note of some of the statistics. The canteen. I must have been hungry when I watched this, because I made loads of notes about the canteens. They've got four canteens catering for about 5,000 people a day. They get through, I think this is per year, 316 tonnes of baked beans, 26,000 loaves, and 500,000 sausages. That's a big breakfast.
Good job they're working outside, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, except the tunnellers, of course. Yeah, absolutely fascinating.
Well, episode one, as you say, was all focused on the logistics and the very tight logistics of the concrete pour. I'm rather hoping that tonight's episode is going to feature on some of the lifting equipment. Because, of course, we've got Big Carl there.
Yes,
which,
of course.
Depending how you define crane and land-based and crawler or whatever, can be defined as the world's biggest land-based lattice boom crane. And I'm hoping we get to hear the operator of the crane talk tonight, or the people who built it and erected it, and have a little bit of insight into that.
Yeah, I thought as a glimpse into the life of the Hinkley Point project, it was absolutely fascinating. And I don't know how many episodes there are, but the second one is on tonight, BBC Two at 9 p.m.
Hinkley Point and HS2 are the big things we want to talk about. But there was another completely different, interesting report that came across my desk in the past week, which is from a firm of architects called GT3 Architects.
Oh, yes.
I'm not particularly familiar with them, but they specialise in the design of sports and leisure facilities. And they've been doing some research into inclusive design to understand the issues that different types, should we mean types, different people,
different sectors,
when
yes,
visiting leisure centres,
underrepresented groups, I think was a phrase they talked about.
Well, it's not just underrepresented, because the first study they looked at was the experience of adults taking young children to a leisure centre, and I think they must be probably the biggest users of leisure centres. They're probably a lone parent with one or more toddler in tow to teach them how to swim.
Yeah.
That must be the number one activity, I would have thought, I would guess.
I imagine it's that and probably people in their 20s and 30s using the gym. That's probably... Those are the two main areas, I should think. Certainly not the likes of you and I anymore, Phil. Maybe...
No, I maybe we haven't been to a leisure centre for a long time.
Well, the last time I went to a leisure centre was to get a COVID jab, so that gives you an idea of the way I use my local leisure facilities. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted. Let's carry on.
But anyway, this firm of architects have basically suddenly realised that they and everyone else have been doing it wrong all these years. They talk about adults taking young children to a leisure centre as caregivers. So that's in the context of caregivers, this is what they're talking about.
Right.
So they discovered that 85% of caregivers they surveyed find incredibly difficult to deal with the challenges of a leisure centre, such as where to put a child while you get changed, or how to get into the pool safely if your child cannot stand by themselves, particularly when alone. 59% of people surveyed say that they are usually the only adult responsible for their child or children when they visit the leisure centre. And this word stressful kept coming up time and again. Most people want to visit the leisure centre more often, but find it difficult. So they're basically saying, if we can design leisure centres with caregivers in mind, with the problem of these frequent users, not say lone parents, but on the occasion of the visit, solo parents, with a child or more than one child, If you think, right, this is a target market, are we making use of this leisure centre? Are we designing it to be as easy for them as possible?
Yeah.
And the answer is not. Clearly, it's not. And so this firm of architects is saying that ideas that they're now coming up with, safe parking and access to the facility, I would have thought that would be a given, a waiting area in reception, clear wayfinding, so you can navigate your way around.
Mm-hmm.
Buggy stores near the changing rooms, somewhere to put the buggies, and considered family changing rooms. In other words, you know, space to actually change two young children with you, whatever. Other things that I thought were more interesting and equally obvious, talk about things like the windows are too high, so that you can't, if you've got a toddler on the other side, you can't see them without sort of getting right up to the window and sticking your nose out, saying, you know, where's little Johnny gone? And so these sort of, the height of handrails when going into the water was not always right. Paul Reed, associate director, did it, and Judith Atkinson, who led the survey. Judith Atkinson, project architect, says, I firmly believe that by understanding caregivers' experiences, such as knowing that 50% consider that a waiting area within the reception is important, or that 96% want a family-friendly cubicle, we can make leisure centres become more inclusive. So I just think it's kind of obvious, and especially the fact this is a firm of architects who specialise in this. What took him so long?
Yes, it is. It is. That's exactly what I thought when I saw that. It does seem strange that this hadn't dawned on people before. But then I suppose somebody's got to think of it first. Certainly some of the shortcomings that they identified, I immediately recognised because, I said just now that I haven't used a leisure centre for many years, but when I had three small kids, used to use it quite regularly. And yes, exactly that problem. You know, the family changing rooms, if there were family changing rooms, were small and difficult to use. And in fact, at my local leisure centre, I can't remember if there were any family changing rooms, but there was basically just one bench which wasn't big enough to put everything on, just one hook to put all your clothes on, and a puddle on the floor that never went away. And you've got to change three kids and yourself, get them in the pool, get them out again, dry them, get them changed. And yes, it was a bloody nightmare. And, I'm not a great fan of indoor swimming pools at the best of times, but that really made it a stressful experience. So I think they're absolutely right. I think that we are, it is time for a redesign. In fact, my local leisure centre is about to be replaced because I'll give them a shout out. Speller Metcalf, the contractor, is building a new one for me.
It's been just designed for you.
Well, me and the rest of North Devon, but there's a new. But Barnstaple's getting a new leisure centre. I was quite surprised that the project is 14 million, which doesn't sound like a lot for a leisure centre, especially when it's got a 25-metre swimming pool in it, and it's got. And this I want to see. It's got an endless ski slope. I'm not sure they describe it as endless, but it's basically a ski slope that just doesn't stop. You get on at the top, and I think it must be like a big treadmill or something. Yeah, something like that. I'd love to see it. But a 25-metre swimming pool and an endless ski slope, I reckon that's good value for 14 million. But anyway, they're building this right next door to the... Well, between the existing one and the local tennis centre, and presumably when it's finished, they'll knock down the old one. But the old one definitely was, life expired. It was 20 years ago. It was not a pleasant place to visit from my point of view, and with three small kids, as I said. And the architect for the new one is a outfit based in Loughborough called Watson Batty, and I haven't had time to ask them about their design criteria, but it'd be interesting to see if what they've built into this design matches the sort of criteria that GT3 are saying are necessary.
I would imagine an architect based in Loughborough would be designing swimming pools purely with the view of finding Olympic champions.
Probably, yes. They do that sort of thing up in Loughborough, don't they? I'm sure they know what they're doing. The CGIs I've seen look pretty good. Looks like a nice facility. So let's hope that it will be family friendly and inclusive when it's finally built. Should be anyway.
My problem when I used to go to leisure centres is there was too much deep end.
That's something to do with your stature, Phil.
I was happier paddling. I was never the world's strongest swimmer.
No, neither was I. But then I spent nearly all my time in the kids' pool trying to stop my children from drowning. So I'm used to the shallow end. I'll report back when it's finished anyway. It gives me an incentive to go to the new facility and check it out. Anything else caught your eye this week, Phil, before we finish?
Well, we occasionally indulge ourselves in our own perspectives on life as a trade press journalist.
Yeah.
And I don't know, sometimes listeners tell me they're quite interested to hear what our perspective is, and other times I think maybe just being self-indulgent and talking about our own lives rather than about the wider construction industry. But, I did get a press release across my desk this week, which is a classic, classic case study of how not to, not so much how not to write a press release, but what not to put in a press release.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to embarrass the company by naming them, because they rapidly realised they'd made a severe, serious faux pas. And we're on the phone within an hour saying, "Oh, can you delete that last sentence, please? That shouldn't have been there. I don't know how that slipped through."
Mm-hmm.
Now, we often get press releases where someone's, we've won a contract, and the quotes are always trite. We are so excited that we've won this job, and we look yeah. forward to delivering a magnificent building or some such, which adds nothing to the story.
Yeah.
So quotes, if you are sending in a press release or writing a press release, only put a quote in if it adds something, please.
Yeah.
And don't put a quote in when, if you're announcing the appointment that you've recruited a senior person from another organisation to a senior position in your organisation who is clearly eminently qualified, and it's very newsworthy that the senior person is joining your organisation. Don't say, if you're her boss, "Her appointment is very encouraging and fully supports our commitment to a more diverse organisation."
Oh, God.
So you're the senior woman that's just joined a new organisation, and you're being told your boss considers you a diversity hire.
Yeah.
I knew it was trite. I was not going to use that sentence when I got it. I thought, this is shocking. I thought about making a story out of it itself, and I thought, no, someone will catch on, know that they've boobed here. Just run the quote in full as it's been given to us, and wait for the proverbial to hit the fan. And first one on the phone was the company concerned. Say, "Yeah, okay, we know what we did there. Please take it out." I'm amazed it ever slipped through. "We've appointed a woman. Look at us. Aren't we great?"
Yeah, well, precisely. That's it in a nutshell. And I am surprised that a major, big organization should make such a faux pas. But, I certainly get, and I'm sure you do quite regularly, press releases about appointments where the emphasis is on, "Look at us, we're doing our bit for diversity because we're appointing somebody from a racial minority or somebody from, somebody from a different gender." So, really, don't tell us you do it, just do it, because yes, it's good. And you should
show
be doing
don't
this.
Tell is the
show
thing.
Don't tell. Yeah, exactly. The minute you start making that the story, I think you've really blown the gaff. You've shown that you're not really sensitive to the real issues.
It was this woman's first day in the organisation, first day at work, and she reads that and you think,
"Yeah,
blimey,
yeah,
welcome."
Precisely. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it doesn't happen that often, but it does happen occasionally.
A lesson for all.
Yeah, I think there is a tendency for people on the publicity side of an organisation, either a third-party PR consultant or in-house PR, to try and spin stories like that by emphasising what they think are perhaps the virtue signalling aspects of it. And it sounds clunky and clumsy and backfires. And
offensive.
Yeah. But there you are. Nobody's perfect.
Anyway.
Are we done?
I think we are. I think that's another episode of Reconstruction gone by in a flash. I have no idea what we might be talking about next week, but it's sunny. I've decided that my garden is rewilding itself, so I'm firmly on trend. Although I'm sure rewilding should be more about just nettles. So might have to add some dock leaves to the nettles to make
yes,
it a proper job.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Do watch that Hinkley Point documentary. It's on iPlayer. Episode 1 was on the 2nd of June. Episode 2... the 9th of June, Wednesday. It's well worth a watch. It's an Open University production, or they're involved in it, so it's not too sensationalist. It's good and proper,
yeah.
Although it is sensational, because it's a sensational project. But from David and I, that's all we're doing for this week. So thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.